Our U.S. government tour through AI and data centers continues. Earlier this year, we ran a show with Margie Palmieri from the Pentagon CDAO, but state wanted in on the action too. To represent for Foggy Bottom and give a sense of how the State Department is hoping to do more with data and AI, I'm happy to have on today Garrett Burnson, the State Department's Deputy Chief Data Officer. He previously served as an officer during two tours in Afghanistan and recently rotated off the NSC. Garrett!
Hey, Jordan, how are you?
So I think it is relatively straightforward for our listeners to sort of imagine how AI can be applied in a Defense Department context, going from logistics all of a sudden, you know, all the way up to crazy drone swarms, which are going to, you know, conquer the seas. But in one of the policy documents that the State Department recently put out, you guys declared that data can be more effective with comprehensive, timely, and accurate data and intuitive analysis. So pitch me, Garrett. What is the vision for how data can inform and enhance diplomacy?
Sure. Thank you, Jordan, for having me. I'm happy to give the pitch. I think fundamentally, when we look at what the activities of diplomacy are, what are our widgets? They are mostly words and information. That has been the currency of diplomacy for hundreds of years, and it remains the currency of diplomacy of our hardworking staff overseas and domestically. And the advances in LLMs and large language models and generative artificial intelligence, those really are tools to help manage, store, analyze data and information through the written word. And so our vision at the State Department for the use of these technologies is to use them to augment every single thing that our staff and that our workforce does globally, whether it's negotiations, whether it's management functions, whether it's reporting, open source analysis, or other types of analysis, all of those things can be made faster, easier, better through data and AI.
So I've done a number of episodes this year looking back over the course of history about how technological change has and hasn't been taken advantage of by military organizations over the course of the 19th and 20th century. But I think there is a kind of broader understanding within the, military thinkers, at least into the 20th century, that technological change is something you need to really lean into and understand and adapt towards if you're going to outcompete your adversaries. But, you know, we're still having this meme in the 21st century where senior diplomats talk about diplomacy as an art, not a science. And, you know, in the military context, you could kind of get away with like, you know, bravery is the thing that gets you there because the pace of change was so slow in the, you know, 100s and 200s and 300s all the way, you know, probably pre-industrial revolution that like you could sort of evolve with the times and you didn't necessarily need, you know, one generation to learn two or three different technological paradigms. But that's not necessarily the case with diplomacy. So I guess, Garrett, what have been the sort of cultural challenges, I guess, in turning what is such a human, you know, interpersonal endeavor and the people who signed up for it, who were presumably excited about that part of the game, to buy into your vision?
There's a couple of things, and we have these discussions all the time. And I think the first, I think, this most obvious easiest pitch is basically we're never going to remove that sort of magic diplomatic moment where you're in the office, you know, you're negotiating across the table from someone, or you're in the field, you're talking with a local counterpart, you're making a relationship. That's not ever going to be an artificial intelligence doing that work. What we do want to do, though, is reduce your overall burden and, you know, you talk to Foreign Service officers overseas. They're like, I wish I could spend less time doing the same repetitive stuff, and I want to go out and do more of what I joined the Foreign Service to do. And so telling them those things, that we can automate those things, that we can make them easier for them, that's like the sort of first pitch, right? That is the easiest pitch. The second pitch is more to the heart of the mission of diplomacy. And it's saying you deserve the fastest, most accurate analysis to help you in that moment of negotiation. You know, if you look at sort of the example of like baseball, hundreds of years old, people say it's not a data-driven sport. We now know fundamentally Moneyball, right, the movie, and that, you know, it, everyone understands now, no, there's like deep sort of data analysis that can help prepare teams, be winning teams. That doesn't mean that those data science tools at the plate help you hit the home run. They're not going to hit the home run for you, but they're going to put you in the position to have the best team, to have the best information at your fingertips, where you are to do your job. And that is the hard, it is the harder pitch, I will say. And the proof is in the pudding when you bring an analysis to someone who's been in the department for a long time and they say, this is counter to my, like what I believe to be true. And that does happen. You know, it does happen that you bring in analysis and they say, I've been in the Foreign Service for 30 years and this is not correct. And that's where the rubber meets the road. And when we have those moments, the first thing we say is, this is an analysis. All models are wrong. Some are useful. Maybe we have something wrong in here, but let's have a discussion about why your intuition counters this analysis. And let's all be smarter and have like a better outcome from that back and forth.
You led with the, I'm not taking away anyone's job thing,
yeah.
But like, I mean, I can imagine a, you know, GPT-6, George Kennan's like plus Henry Kissinger plus like ethics model, which is like actually better than your replacement level Foreign Service officer. This is, of course, talking to someone who did not pass the Foreign Service officer exam. So let's be clear there. But I mean, have you, like, I'm sure you haven't brought this up too much to not scare people away from the vision, but what is your, like, in a world where AI becomes much more, you know, marginally or substantially more powerful than it is today, like, how far do you think this sort of thing can end up going?
Yeah, those are tough questions to answer. And we do get those questions. I think I'm not a futurist. You know, I don't know what the world is going to look like in 20 or 30 years. I like to read the same fun books, science fiction books about, you know, the future, but I don't know sort of like how close we are to AGI and all of that. And I wouldn't wade into that. What I know now is we are in a world where American diplomacy is needed and we need our Foreign Service officers and our diplomats and our civil servants doing this work. And many of them are burdened with things that they are, that they candidly like could be doing more efficiently. And the more we can push them forward to negotiation, to engagement with partners, to those soft skills, those activities that I don't think we're going to, maybe in my grandkids' time or my great grandkids' time, we'll have AI bots negotiating in the UN. I don't know. That seems crazy to me. But in the world we live in right now, our allies need us out in their capitals, working with them hand in glove. And I want to buy more hours every day and every week for those Foreign Service officers to do that work. And I'll let people smarter than me talk about replacement and, you know, how do we change the workforce and all that stuff.
I mean, we don't necessarily have to go that far, right? But like, take your UN Security Council negotiation, right? Like, I don't see us being that far away from like simulating models of the 15 countries and trying to have those agents negotiate with each other and run that simulation 10,000 times and like start with like 20 different strategies and figure out the optimal one that's going to get the most people on board. I mean, there's I think like a ton of ways of being creative with this. I don't even know if this is going to end up being in the show, but
that's
like,
okay. We'll talk about it. I think like, so first of all, the Bureau of International Organizations, IO, they are a very forward-leaning organization on using data and analysis to inform their operations. They have, we started a program, a sort of a workforce program from our team helping bureaus hire Bureau Chief Data Officers, BCDOs. And they were one of the first ones. And they actually hired someone away from my team. Her name's Paula. She's phenomenal. And they love these types of things. And so I love that you bring it up because they do look at modeling and evaluating and simulations. But at the end of the day, it is to inform our negotiators. It is to give them, the best tools to be ready to think about the second, third, and fourth order effects and sort of all of those things that you need to do to negotiate. It's your broader point on could we someday put into an agent-based simulation my preferences, your preferences, 10 people's preferences, have it do some sort of like analysis. That could happen. I just don't know if like in our society, people are ready for that, to give up that sort of control. I don't think I would be, but
yeah, it's an interesting question. And it kind of comes back to this tension of, on the one hand, government, you know, in your documents, you talk about how you want, you know, industry leading practices, but the sort of, the extent to which the State Department can push the envelope versus, you know, a PE firm that wants to have agents negotiate its deals for them when there's necessarily less on the line, I think is a really interesting tension. So maybe explore that a little bit, Garrett, of like, on the one hand, you guys trying to run just as fast as, a Fortune 500 company trying to implement this stuff, while at the same time, you know, the stakes are a lot higher on a number of dimensions for the issue sets that you guys have to tackle.
Totally. We are never going to keep completely at pace with a PE firm, because our incentives are they're just completely different. It is apples and oranges. We are making decisions on behalf of the American people and are negotiating things that really impact people's lives. Buying and selling or trading, you know, stocks automatically with an AI bot, that's just like totally different. And that impacts people's lives too, obviously. But we have a sort of special trust given to us as public officials and civil servants and federal employees. So, you know, I think in terms of timeline to roll out some of these things, we're always going to have to do a little bit more homework, and we are not willing to take as much risk as a private equity firm. I think we should go as fast as we can under the law and how hard it is to change the way our workforce sort of works. But benchmarking us to that, I don't even find super valuable personally.
Like, I think there are sort of different, there are different like buckets of tasks of just this type of stuff that you laid out over the past 15 minutes where like it's kind of okay to run as fast.
Yeah.
Versus the sorts of things where it's not so much. So maybe why don't you break that down to me?
A lot of the work we do in the management area, that is much more analogous to the work of the private sector. We're talking about delivering high quality HR services, IT services, performance management, all of these things that, candidly, I do think we need to be much closer to delivering quality software that executes that in the way that the private sector does. There are lots of efforts to do that. There's modernization. Some of it is some of it's IT, some of it's process and workforce. That is kind of the area where we want to be as close to the private sector as possible. Break. When it comes to the things that are almost uniquely public activities, we're talking about implementing the law, rulemaking. We're talking about providing foreign assistance, or if you're I'm just thinking of the State Department, we do foreign assistance funds, we do passport adjudications, we do consular decisions, right? No one else decides who gets a passport. That is a U.S. government activity. I think in those areas where they're rights impacting, where we have concerns, and this is outlined, a lot of this is outlined in the executive order in terms of uses of AI, we have a higher burden there as a sole provider of a public good to do it right. And if that means we do have to go a little bit slower, because yes, we do need more lawyers to be a part of it, we need to be cautious and test it. I think that's where the expectation that we're going to be as fast as private equity firm or however you want to benchmark us, I think that's kind of less of a productive comparison. Also, sure. No private equity firm has to give out passports. If a company was producing passports and then was going to face the litigation risk of getting that wrong, I actually think they would be very cautious also. So I think that's where I would kind of bifurcate your question from what are the areas we need to keep up with industry and what are the areas where, yeah, we need to be more cautious and get it, be 100% sure that we're sort of getting it right.
Let's talk about China for a second. So sure. One of your strategies of getting buy-in has been running these sort of like 6-month data campaigns or like sprints of sorts to bring all your analysts and try to tackle a problem and show that data has value. I am aware that you guys recently ran one around China and strategic competition. What are some interesting findings you can share from that work?
So State CDAO has had a long-running relationship with a number of different offices doing work on sort of strategic competition, EAP, and other offices, of course, that touch the issue. I think a couple kind of specific examples. First of all, we provide globally, the State Department provides globally a lot of foreign assistance funding, and there are accounts in particular on countering the PRC influence. There's a particular fund called Countering PRC Influence Fund. And with them and with EAP and a number of other stakeholders, right, like we wanted to optimize the best possible way to divvy out those funds. And that is actually a great problem for data, right? You look for some indicators of impact. You can build sort of like a cost and impact evaluation model. And then this is going back to Jordan, what we talked about before. That doesn't mean you take 1 through N and the model spit out 1 through N. And so we're going 1 through N. It means that informs a discussion with policymakers. And it is one additional factor in the broader sort of foreign assistance decision-making process. That, I think, really broke some new ground, and it provided an ability for decision-makers to evaluate all these projects in a sort of apples-to-apples way as best as we could and make some portfolio decisions on foreign assistance. Another interesting use case, it was sort of a study that we ran basically looking at the entirety of the cable traffic. So the Department of State, our foreign service officers overseas, produce cable reporting on a variety of different issues, national security issues, economic issues, political issues. But no one had really taken that entire corpus and evaluated it using sort of like large language models, not generative AI, just general sort of AI tools and evaluative tools, and look at the entire corpus and say, what are we really reporting on? Actually, like in aggregate, and how can we evaluate what we're reporting on and then go back to posts and say, we are looking for these reporting priorities and having that sort of global perspective on what's being reported, a novel concept that we sort of did in partnership with other stakeholders and then produced some findings, gave that, again, this always sort of sounds like the same rote thing, but this is how we operate. We have questions, hypotheses, we test them with data, we provide insights and reports to decision makers to make decisions and to engage with the field about how they want differing sort of reporting priorities.
So speaking of clear talking points, Garrett, you wrote a piece a few years ago with Ryan Fedashuk talking about the sort of new, I don't know, Biden doctrine or whatever. That we saw probably most dramatically illustrated in the run-up to the war in Ukraine of, like, revealing things that are secret. You had this great line, every government has its secrets, but some need them more than others. So I'm curious, you know, when you're doing these studies for various bureaus and the department as a whole, both those as well as more broadly, like, how are you thinking about bringing that type of energy to the work that you're doing?
Good digging on some research there. Hold me accountable to my own words. I think there is a spectrum of sort of that philosophical belief in the department. I would say I am probably an outlier towards transparency. I'll bifurcate this again to like sort of internally and then externally. There's sort of both challenges. Internally, sure. I think knowledge management and sharing information inside of the department, I would really like us to be more aggressive with doing that. And I think we have buy-in, honestly, from our leadership to do that. We have heard from our Deputy Secretary, Rich Verma, Ambassador Verma, has looking to modernize the way we share information and the way we take a little bit more risk. The secretary has also said this. He says, we need to be trying new things. We need to be taking a little bit more risk. And so I think taking their lead, this is an area where we can be take a little bit more risk internally, sharing information more transparently, just raising challenges and addressing policy differences in a transparent way. So I think that's the internal. On the external, that's really where my article was talking a little bit more. I think it's actually been codified. I wish I'd come up with this because this is actually the best thing to call it. Strategic disclosure is I think what sort of it's been called. Again, if I had coined that, that would be cool, but I did not. I had some, I don't know, I said transparency or something, weaponizing transparency, which is less cool. Strategic disclosure, I think, is fundamentally the sort of way it's being called in the sort of Biden administration paradigm. I think I can't speak for the sort of decisions at the White House to do that. What I would say, and what I was trying to say in this article, is we as a sort of democratic republic, it is a power that we can be as transparent as we are. It's powerful in our markets. It's powerful in terms of communicating to the world and the public how we operate. I think, you know, some of our adversaries, it's actually a weakness. They really want to keep things secret. And we have a lot of tools in the modern era, not just in government, but outside of government. Like you see the incredible work CSET does to produce these data sets where they're doing research and they're making them easy to access. We, I think, as the U.S. and again, as a sort of more of a transparent democracy, it is our advantage to drive transparency. And I think both internally, we're seeing more moves that way. And as you said, the administration really believes in that doctrine. They use it and have used it, I think, to great effect in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting sort of exploring that concept. We'll come back to the internal question. But like there's two things, I think, with the transparency piece. Like one is, I mean, I'd like to think that like America does less like horrifically objectionable things. And second, the horrifically objectionable things, because we live in a free press, will end up, you know, coming out regardless of whether it's a state secret or not. I mean, you saw that over the course of the, you know, 2000s with Abu Ghraib and the secret detention sites. And, you know, there's plenty of other things which, you know, there's, you have books like Ashes of History, which are allowed to get written and the author isn't assassinated for it. You know, the ability to keep like dark secrets is just not something that this country like ends up sustaining, regardless of what level of classification you put on things. So kind of baking that into your assumptions and trying to leverage that is a really interesting framing when you're trying to think about, you know, asymmetric advantages with more closed societies.
Yeah, I agree.
So coming back to the internal thing, you got this trade-off, right, where after the 9/11 commission, everyone was really upset about silos. And then you had all this like silo breaking going on. And then we got Snowden and everyone's like, oh, man, nothing is siloed. Like one guy can download every State Department, every State Department cable and like embarrass us. So I'm curious, you know, it's been 10 years, right, which is like enough of a 10 years without like a really giant leak over the on the level that Snowden was, which, you know, is not surprising where you're getting people being fed up and open to doing things that, as you phrase, are like a little more risky. I'm curious then, Garrett, like, what do you think the balance is between sort of like the challenges in making that internal information sharing happen better, you know, when you're looking at sort of like top and mid-level buy-in, as opposed to just like the technical challenge of like, you know, prying open those silos and letting the, you know, information grain flow out?
Yeah, both challenges exist and are real. On the technology front, I think actually what's so incredible about really the last like 5 years is just the breakthroughs in sort of managing data access, roles-based access, whether it's privacy, enhancing technologies. There's a whole, I won't get like super, super technical here, but there's a whole world of new technologies, encryption technologies that are there to try to help us kind of have our cake and eat it too here. Where
let's go into it. Let's do the 4 minute riff.
Yeah. I mean, effectively, you know, because of a lot of these technology companies wanting to leverage huge amounts of what is private data and do analysis and provide products on that, but also manage those people's privacy, they've invested tons of money to sort of figure that problem out. Genericize things, or buzzword is like a PET, a privacy enhancing technology, and avoiding things like the mosaic effect, where, you know, if we don't name you, but if we say enough things about you, then you can like triangulate that was you at your hair appointment and, you know, going to your house and stuff like that. So there's a whole lot of work that has been done to try to solve those problems. And there's always a balance, you know, if you really look really, really deep into it, you can probably figure out who people are in some of these systems. But there is more of a balance where you can manage people's privacy information and still do analysis on certain data. And I think that can be true, in the department as well, as we sort of move into as we gain better technologies to do this type of stuff. I think so talking through the sort of policy incentives on sharing and openness, there have not historically, or for the last 10 years or so, been a post-Snowden, been a ton of incentives to drive transparency. It is almost all, if you are transparent and open with your data, that opens you to risk and you get no upside, effectively. Mm-hmm. Like, from a sort of institutional standpoint, as a leader, why even open yourself up to that risk if there's no real reward to that? And that sounds sort of cynical, but people do work around incentives, career incentives, risk, organizational risk. That is a real thing that impacts people's decision making. What has changed somewhat in the last 5 years is the Evidence Act. This law that came out, actually maybe more than 5 years now, 2018 or something, 6 or 7 years ago. And it was a landmark law that established my office, established all of these chief data offices across government, and it started to, and follow-up legislation has started to change those incentives. It's starting to ask these things that Congress can do. It's asking for reporting. It's, you know, getting a GAO or a CRS report on the implementation process. All of those things start to change the incentives a little bit more towards, well, why are you not sharing? We're going to call you out now, not for doing it. And that is an important incentive. And then it also creates these leaders, my boss and my office, and other agencies too, who have chief data or chief data and AI officers, as many have added AI to the title in the last year. You know, it creates these senior people whose voice is now in the room to say, we have to connect this system. We have to expose internally to other systems, not exposed to the world, but exposed to other IT systems, critical data so that people can do their jobs better. And then I think the last factor I would add is this improvement in software in the world. Just what every human being gets access to, especially Americans get access to, has gotten so much better and so personalized that our customers in our agencies are almost like, I have to have a personalized experience when I use the software. Their expectation has just changed is so much higher than it was, that they're just calling for it in terms of just, if you want me to do my job, I need to have the software tools, good personalized software to me. The expectation has really changed.
Sorry, what do you mean by personalized software to me?
Yeah. So, you know, basically, as you exist in your world, as you use Google, as you use social media, obviously, but as you use a messaging app, as you use Uber, you know, any way you interact with software in your day-to-day, it is being personalized to you. It is, it knows your buying habits. It knows your search history. To my earlier point about privacy, they're walling that off as they serve it to you so that it's not easy to just tap into, but they know an enormous amount about you. And so your software experience is much better. Your search experience, as you use ChatGPT, you know, it knows your prior history that you've been talking with it about. And that expectation is much higher now. And our workforce, you can see our workforce sort of saying, we expect that kind of experience too.
It's funny because you had to explain it to me and I was like, oh, wait, no, this is so obvious. I haven't even thought of it. But then I don't know to what extent you can talk about like what this means when it doesn't happen in the State Department. Can you, or should I just like hypothesize?
No, we can talk a little bit about it because, so I think you can probably use a couple examples would be sort of useful. A ton of the work of the department is engaging, writing, drafting, reading, and engaging with information, with the open source news, or with cables or email, right? Like it's many people in the department are knowledge workers. Fundamentally, they are reading, processing, doing analysis. And we are starting to personalize those experiences for them. It is not, there's progress being made. My team, other teams in other parts of the department are doing incredible work, starting to personalize those experiences for you. When you get into your office in a future state, if you're a Foreign Service officer, you take the test, you pass the test, you don't want to be a podcaster anymore. If you join the Foreign Service, hopefully by then, when you sit down, your reading experience is for you. It knows what office you're in. It knows what you are interested in, what you should be reading about. And we're starting to do that, but it really, you know, the ideal is we're not there. And we are making progress, but we have more progress to make.
So say I walk in the door tomorrow as a AAAS fellow, you know, am I getting to code with Copilot and write my cables with like a GPT-4 level thing? Like where are we today on getting folks access to those tools?
We are very close. We have access to some large language models, but the process, I want to bore you with federal IT. I'll give you the TLDR, right? You know, there are multiple gates to evaluate. There is a sort of FedRAMP security process, which is managed by GSA. And then once a piece of software and application has been tested and evaluated for security there, we go through department evaluations on it. And that's where we are. And that's where many agencies are. And there is a great effort being run out of the White House right now under the executive order, the AI executive order, of all of these technologists, senior technologists coming together and saying, what are you working on? How are you getting this tool? Is your, you know, and that's I think, super powerful. People trying to figure out these questions that are not, there's not a great playbook for a lot of these things. It's totally new and novel. And so we're trying to accelerate the learning and get those tools into the hands of our customers as soon as possible. There's a lot of demand for it. We just did a simple form, like, would you use a GPT style tool? And in a couple of days, we had like 1,500 people say, yes, I totally would. So that's the demand signal. And I think we're trying to meet the moment on that demand signal and get things to people. But also, and I don't want to like, feel like I have to caveat everything, but we have to do it carefully, and we have to do it in partnership with our IT experts who are evaluating cyber risk and managing all of the sort of safety in our environment, because we can't, the worst thing we could do is have some sort of huge failure, like a hack or some big problem, loss of sensitive data or something like that. I think that's the worst thing we could do. We'd set ourselves back a lot. So we need to get it right.
All right. So not yet, but soon, hopefully.
Soon.
Gotcha. So let's talk about the sort of organizational design of State's CDAO. You know, obviously, you're working with a different order of magnitude of budget and talent than you get at the Pentagon. And you have this, you know, much more knowledge worker orientation. So how did you sort of think about, you know, what type of talent you wanted in, how you were going to structure it, and also sort of what needed to be done by, you know, GS civil servants as opposed to the types of stuff that you could have external contractors take a load on?
At the very beginning, and I'm sort of personally lucky, I've been there through the whole journey. I was an employee number 3 on the team, 6 years ago, and sort of have seen the whole thing change. Proud to have been a part of it. And there was a decision made that we should not be sort of like these scientists in the back room who've like, you know, I got an idea. You know what I think the department needs is this thing, this analysis. The total opposite is sort of was put into our founding principles, which is we should find out what the department needs the most, and we should work on that. And so we are kind of an internal consultancy. People literally, there's a form. If you are listening to this and you are a State Department employee, you can go to our website on the intranet internally and you can submit a project request. And so we get hundreds of project requests, though. We didn't at the very beginning, but, you know, now we do. It just shows there's a huge demand for this type of work. And so we are demand driven. And at the beginning, that was a lot of kind of ginning up interest. Oh, would you want a project? You know, we're going to do data science. And people were like, what are you talking about? We don't need data science in the department. But we had some early buy-in from some people who thought, yeah, that is actually kind of cool. And we delivered some projects. And each project, then people just started to see and said, oh, wow, that's really useful. You know, this is the best compliment you can ever get. That's useful. That makes my life easier. And so that's kind of how we started to grow in this approach of delivering projects for customers, trying to be super customer oriented, making sure that they had what they needed, and delivering analysis. And the things we give our people are analysis, dashboards. We can build databases. We can build software. We can do sort of all of these things. When we started, it was much narrower, and we sort of started to grow into other kind of verticals of analysis. Also, technology has improved. We never thought, we had some ideas 5 years ago, AI was going to be useful. We didn't know at all what that would look like. And now people, you know, need AI tools and we're looking at building AI tools. So that is hopefully helpful sort of to understand the op model. And working backwards from that op model, we started to have much more of a need for really strong government technologists. That is a really hard thing to recruit for. Technologists, if you've seen the market right now, are in huge demand. These layoffs from like the big 7, notwithstanding, technologists are super in demand right now. And so we have taken a lot of time and worked really closely with our Bureau of Global Talent Management, which is our HR bureau, basically. And we've used some really unique approaches to hiring technologists into government. In particular, we use something, it's a wild acronym, but it's called the Subject Matter Expert Qualification Assessment, the SMEQA. And we have used this SMEQA, which is a skills-based hiring, which kind of takes federal hiring and turns it on its head, where it says, we're actually going to give you a written test, we'll give you a data set, and ask you to come up with an analysis, and then we'll evaluate that. And then, of course, we do interviews and all that stuff. And we've hired I could go on and on about how incredible our workforce is in my team, but we've hired just phenomenal people off of that and of course, other hiring mechanisms as well.
I want to come back to this, like, internal, like, civil servant technologist versus what you're kind of bringing in from the private sector. Like, I hope you guys aren't training your own frontier models, but you know there's like a level of technical ambition, which I think a lot of organizations around the world are trying to understand. Where you know you got to a point where it's like, okay, like should we have our own data scientist or can we just pay someone to do this for us? So you know, maybe how are you thinking about that? And what are the sort of unique challenges as a, you know, government entity that deals with national security stuff, you know, compared to Pepsi Cola or whatever?
Yeah. So we do not train our own foundation models. We would need a lot more of an investment in GPUs and TPUs to make that happen. So we have a really collaborative sort of cross-functional team that includes civil servants, who I did just talk a bunch about, but we have foreign service officers, right, who are the sort of lifeblood of the department. We have contractors, multiple different contractors that we use and who are incredible partners for us, and we use software companies. I mean, most of these things, most of these types of tools and approaches can be bought commercial off the shelf, a lot of them. And when we can buy commercial off the shelf, we buy commercial off the shelf. We may need to change that 5 or 10% to make sure it works for our use case, for the State Department, for foreign service officers, for our global workforce, or to comply with certain rules that Pepsi-Cola don't have to comply with, but that we do. And we may make those adjustments, but whenever we can, we're leveraging software that is commercial off the shelf. Some things we built custom in-house, but that's much rarer. You're not going to build, you know, a better cloud environment than any of the big cloud companies. They kind of have that figured out. And so we leverage those, a host of vendors, software companies, and a big mix of workforce too. The last thing I'll say, got to give a shout out to, there are a ton of really, really good federal, talent programs. So there's one I got to give a shout out to, the U.S. Digital Corps, USDC, which is only 3, I think, years old. They're awesome. We've hired a ton of great people from them. These are fellowships. You know, we've used the AAAS fellowship. We've looked at PIFs and PMFs. You got to be scrappy on the HR stuff. When I started this job, I did not know very much about federal HR, but I feel like it's like 50% of my time now. And you really just, you got to go out and engage with people and pitch them and say, this is a great place to work. You got to come give it a try, you know, meet the team. And so that's, we do spend a lot of time, I personally, but also the whole leader team. We have a really good leader team in my organization, and everyone knows, like, hiring and recruiting, super important. Always be recruiting.
So what are the, I guess what, aside from getting people in the door, what like have and haven't you been able to adapt to in the, you know, in the experience of what these folks could be having versus working at Google or Salesforce?
Yeah. You know, I think we're honest up front that we just are unlikely to pay you as much as you could make at a massive technology company. It's better just to be honest about that. But we can pay people well. The federal government is a great, it's got great benefits. You know, it is a good employer. And there's lots of other pros. And I'm a person who's worked in government multiple times and in industry and a think tank and have done a bunch of different jobs. And so I'm just honest, you know, about that. But what we can pitch them is what I kind of allude to what I said earlier. Like, there are certain things that we have a monopoly on. We have a monopoly on diplomacy. We are able to produce analysis that goes to assistant secretaries, deputy assistant secretaries, the Secretary of State, the White House for decision making. That is a unique thing that you get to do here. And you're never going to be able to do that somewhere else. Other parts of government, you can do that, but you can't do that at a tech company. You also have good job stability, you know, you have civil service protections, which are important. And we also try to give people flexibility we're very hybrid friendly kind of office, which is important too. Actually, it's interesting. A huge issue that the State Department has is spouses who travel with foreign service officers abroad. It's a challenge because a lot of people have spouses that are phenomenal, that have a lot of skills and experience. And if they're in, you know, Moscow or they're in, you know, somewhere tough to work on the market, they kind of have to work for the government. We have several data scientists who are working from foreign embassies overseas, and they just are thrilled because they're getting to do what they are trained to do, which they're highly qualified data scientists, and they're getting to have that experience with their partner living overseas, which is a big challenge and a recruitment sort of retention challenge for the department writ large. So those are the pros. You'd be shocked at how many people are just like, I'll take a pay cut. I'm willing to do mission driven work. This generation, and I'm a millennial, but millennials and Gen Z, they're motivated by the mission. And so it's a pretty good pitch. I think our team is the proof, and we have a phenomenal team.
Yeah. So let's pick on Gen X for a little bit then. Garrett, you, in a tweet a while ago, you said that senior leaders are hungry for data, junior staff are too, but middle managers are the most skeptical. I don't know. It's probably not a generational thing, but I'm curious sort of what are the like institutional incentives that are making that kind of level of seniority a little less excited to engage with what you and your team are bringing to the table.
In my perspective, having done this for a bunch of years now, that sort of group of folks in the department are so stretched, just trying to keep the lights on and get paper out the door, that they, you know, taking on a new thing that's going to be innovative and cool and save them time, they're kind of like, I don't know if I've got time to do that. And the second thing is they've probably been around the department for a while, or any agency, if I'm sort of generalizing. And they've seen a ton of waves of this before. They've seen a lot of these, we're going to modernize everything with X new tool 15 years ago. You know, they saw when email rolled out, they were told this is going to make everything easier. And actually it's made their lives, you know, an endless responding to email, you know. So these are folks who have been around the block a little bit more, and they just take a little bit more to prove to them that we're really going to solve their problems and make life easier for them. So there's a healthy skepticism, and we try to balance. Look, I'm a relatively optimistic person, and I try to bring an optimistic energy when I'm pitching these things, but you have to temper it with some expectation setting of, yeah, if we're asking you to change your process, you're not going to just do that overnight. That is going to take some time, and we understand people don't just suddenly want a new tool or a new process. And so you have to be good at communicating sort of realistically while still being optimistic.
I think a number of folks who've come in from the private sector, particularly in the Pentagon, I think, spend 18 months there and then write 2,000 words on LinkedIn about how it's hopeless. And no one wants to do anything and nothing can change. Can you compare and contrast a little bit about, your experience in, it's not a small organization, but it's also not, you know, the Pentagon or the VA, like how that experience may be different in state versus in other larger government bureaucracies?
You know, I think there's similarities and there's differences in every organization. I think no one in any organization loves the amount of time that it can take to coordinate on things. Everybody, I think I come from a place where, like, effectively all of the colleagues that I've, maybe with a very small set of exclusions, people want to move fast. They want to solve problems. They want to get stuff done. And they feel, for whatever reason, that it's just, things are really hard and it's complicated. And we need to kind of, tons of coordination is like always required, and they can feel a little sort of broken down by that. State Department, in my experience, people want to get stuff done, but it is a very personal organization. People want you to reach out and talk to them. They want to be consulted on stuff. I think my time in the Army, people are just more, if it's not in my lane, it's not in my lane. When I was in the Army, I was a logistics officer, colloquially like an S4 for a battalion. And if it was in someone else's staff shop, maybe it was good to know. but it wasn't in my lane. And I mostly just needed to kind of get my lane done to make my battalion commander and others meet the mission. That is not exactly the same. People in the department really want to be engaged sort of horizontally. And so that takes time, and you have to invest in that. And I think we're constantly trying to find the balance of where do we try to just break through the bureaucracy and move faster? And where do we say we have to adapt to the bureaucracy? We are how many thousands of people have come in before and said, oh, I'm the person who uniquely can break the bureaucracy and get stuff done. Many thousands of people. I don't think I'm unique, or, you know, our office is not unique in that way. So we try to adapt whenever possible. And that means a lot of communication, a lot of outreach, and a lot of building relationships with people. We have a sort of superpower in that, which is because we do this, as I kind of explained, we're delivering work for other people. We really try to help people get W's on the board. Like, let them have the W. We don't need to advertise that it was a partnership with us sometimes. Just get the win and, you know, brag about it and put it on your EER, you know, your evaluation report. Great. And that's, you know, by doing that, you start to build some momentum, and people start to say, I think they're really here to kind of help, you know, and they're willing to engage and chip in.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that sort of like, I don't know, horizontal, like octopus tentacle model on which the State Department runs. So, you know, there was a good piece in FP21 recently, I'll put in the show notes. But broadly, like, you alluded to the thing that drives my state friends in the State Department most crazy, which is like getting the paper out the door requires 17 different signatures of people, and like everything is track changed to like, you know, I don't know, not to an inch of its life, like, you know, into the grave. You know, are there any sort of data driven solutions to this sort of like paper out the door sort of approval challenge that a lot of the State Department's work, you know, inevitably ends up seeming to boil down to?
Man, if I could solve the sort of clearance process challenge for the whole department, I would deserve a raise. I think there's...
Well, no. I got it for you, Garrett. Like, you just make bots of all the people who you need the clearance for, and you run it through that, and so you get what their comments would have been anyways. And then, you know, you say no, and you argue with the bot for a little bit, and then you just, like, move on. It's like, look, I talked to your bot. What's the challenge here?
Your avatar signed off on this talking point, so we're good. that's funny. I think a couple things. Like, most projects, when we start a data science project, almost always starts with process. And so we get into a room with customers and we say, what's your process? And they're like, no, I want to talk about the AI. And I want to talk. We're like, no. We don't need to talk about the AI quite yet. We need to understand your process. It's, you know, and so what then people start to say, oh, I see our process. Like, even if you put AI or data science or whatever on top of this problem, the process sort of would make that useless. And so I think there is, and it's a thing that people know smarter than me. I think Dan Spokojny from FP21 talks about this. You know, improving that process is a thing that is constantly being worked on at the department. A technology and sort of data tool to help with that is transparency. And so understanding sort of where are outstanding clearances, how long have clearances been waiting, adding that layer of transparency would be a really powerful approach to this problem. But that takes cultural change. That takes some technology, and that takes changes probably to the process.
So let's come back to this culture issue. You know, you've been on the NSC, on the policy side of things, now, you know, the king of the engineers, or deputy king of the engineers. I want to read you a quote from Trent Hone, a guest I had a few weeks ago. talking about how the Navy started integrating engineers once like ships stopped being wood. And they realized that like these things were complicated and needed technical expertise.
Yeah.
So here's the quote. Ships were organized as if engineers were useful augmentations, not integral parts of shipboard operations. This made little sense for modern ships, which relied heavily on machinery. The engineer-in-chief, Rear Admiral George Melville, summarized the problem. The engineers were a vital part of the military organization, exercising military command over a large and increasing body of men, yet classified as civilians. Furthermore, on board ship, when there was any possibility of doing so, the engineers were invariably humiliated and reminded on all occasions that they were not as good as line officers. This naturally resulted in the bright men of the engineering corps seeking civilian employment, and those who found it necessary to remain from a financial standpoint became disgruntled, disgusted, and always discontented.
That's a great quote.
We have this echoed in the Jen Palka book recently, talking about how, you know, all the glory goes to what you just said, the lifeblood of the organization, the people writing the policy and strategy memos. You just talked about it yourself, about, you know, we'll let them get the W's and the, you know, gold stars or what have you. To what thoughts, reflections on this, Garrett?
I think two things. And one is just informed by my own experience, which I'm likely biased towards, but I have done both sort of what I would call implementation data science work, and I have worked as a, like, doing core, quote, policy work. I just left the NSC and was doing policy work. And so I think, like, the future is not one where there is really any blend between the skills. It's not the Foreign Service officer who says, like, I don't do anything about data. I think that is not our future. I think the future is one where these skills are resident in, like, everybody. And that's would be my vision. I don't get to decide these things, but that is what I would advocate for, is people, technologists, we're understanding technology now is going to literally be a part of every decision. It is critical to trade, to, you know, to war and peace, to everything, to climate. It is not a tack on, you know, it is going to be essential. And so we have to, how do we get to that future? I think we have to hire slightly differently. And the department is starting to do things like add data analysis to its precepts. So the State Department and Foreign Service, they have these sort of precepts that define kind of the important skills. They've added that like 2 years ago. They've added a lot of training. And so, you know, we're going to have, it's going to take a generation, but it's going to take hiring differently. It's going to take training differently. I also would say some of these folks who, I only graduated grad school maybe 10 years ago. Some of the folks I'm seeing coming out of these grad schools, they're like, I have a master's in computer science, machine learning, and like the history of South America. You know, I mean, they're coming, they have these incredibly sort of complex academic experiences where those, you know, I went to SAIS, I have a MA in econ. I learned a little bit of programming, but these schools are really starting to ramp up that blended sort of education. And I think once you start getting those people in the door, right, the culture kind of starts to change. So I think in the long term, it eats the whole org. That's my opinion. I guess it'll be borne out in the next few decades. The second thing I'd say in the more immediate term, we see and are doing the best we can to get these skills as forward to the mission as possible. And so I'll give a couple examples. I mentioned that we have this Bureau Chief Data Officer program. They're in like 13 different bureaus now. And the idea there was, yes, when we first started, it was good to have a partner that another bureau could come to and ask us questions, but we weren't in their bureau. Fundamentally, we weren't. Now they have an expert on staff that reports to them that they, you know, is in every staff meeting, that they can ask for help on these issues. And it's just closer to the mission. That's where we need to be. The NDAA actually has a requirement for this program, saying you need to have bureau CDOs in more bureaus. So there's support for this, and we're seeing it both on the Hill, and we're seeing it already happening in the department. The second example, this is just like a very specific one, but hopefully sort of telling. You know, we have a data scientist who has been for several years working on climate issues, and I think she sort of perfectly encapsulates what I would say is the future of this work. She's like going to COP directly, and when a negotiation team says, hey, this partner just gave me this number or, you know, something, she can do live analysis modeling. Hey, based on this climate model from open source or whatever, they said this, but actually that number doesn't really track with what I'm getting. Boom, hand it back to the negotiator. It's like a superpower. I mean, you know, that immediate live response in negotiations is, I think, the future. People are going to all be enabled with those tools and that kind of information. And that's an example of the sort of decision advantage that we're trying to drive closer to the mission. So you start having those examples and these diplomats who are in these negotiations seeing this superpower like live, that's how you get buy-in. You know, you build buy-in. People say, wow, I am really better informed and more able to do my job. And that's how you sort of get out of we're in the back office, we're the second class citizens, you know, that's how you kind of break that.
Yeah, it's interesting because the sort of, you know, one of the ways in which the Navy got out of this is they started having shooting competitions with, you know, the different boats, and the officers that had the engineering backgrounds, you know, were smarter at building new, you know, range finding tools and, you know, compensating for the waves or what have you. And they started winning and getting noticed and ultimately getting promoted.
Competition.
And now we're in a world. Yeah. And now we're in a world in which like was half the people who run, you know, the services have engineering backgrounds. But like it's with the State Department, it's difficult because the KORs are just more, you know, more abstract. It's like we, on the one hand, yeah, we do a billion, you know, on the one hand, like, yes, you're doing negotiations every day. Like you're going out and talking to, you know, kids in different schools around the world every day. But like quantifying that as opposed to saying this, you know, this new data innovation, like made this one logistics thing easier to get, like, you know, the right amount of bullets into Kandahar or what have you. It just seems like it's both more amorphous as well as the competitive dynamics of like competitive pressures to modernize from the State Department relative to the military context. Because like, look, in military is like you're preparing to and ultimately fight wars where your capabilities are constantly being tested. But in the State Department, like you're, you know, negotiating all the time and there are all these like repeated games and it's not necessarily like the rest of the world is trying to, you know, build AI agents to prep their negotiators, or maybe it's just not as obvious where you're looking at like their tank versus your tank. So how do you try to think about the, you know, aside from things getting written into an NDAA, the sort of competitive pressures that are pushing you guys to hopefully drive forward on this stuff?
It is less black and white. It's less totally clear. You know, can you manufacture a tank faster? Can you hit your naval example, I think, is a good example too. Can you hit the target moving at, you know, 10 knots or whatever? It's more obvious. I sort of remain pretty confident that bureaus that are more willing to be data driven and use advanced tools are going to be doing the things that make them successful faster and better. And if that's on the management side to start, because that's kind of the lower hanging fruit, and it's just they're going to be more efficient, they're going to be better at managing their budget, they're going to be better at hiring, they're going to do all of those things, that in itself is a value add. Ultimately, bureaus are often sort of the management stuff is handled sort of by a PDAS and by an executive secretary, an EX office. There still is competition to run those better than the other bureaus. Any bureaucratic organization, people want to be the best run organization, period. And so there is that competitive pressure. I think you're not wrong that it is harder to measure the addition, you know, the sort of like marginal value of using an AI tool to like write a white paper or, you know, to write a memo. There's this book, The Tyranny of Metrics, you know, it's like, oh, this bureau wrote a ton more. Is that better? Maybe not. Maybe more is worse, actually. Like maybe one cable per year, if it's the perfect cable, is like a better outcome, right? So it's tough to sort of evaluate that specific thing. So I don't have a perfect answer on this question. Honestly, I think we may not even kind of know quite yet what it is. Is it? I think there's research showing that people writing with large language models in support can be more creative, can be faster, can write better. They can also write worse, right? I mean, this is not totally linear, these tools can make things pull up insights that you didn't realize because it's looking at the last 20 years of cables and it pulled up some ideas that you were like, oh, wow, I didn't even think about that. We thought about that issue, 5 years ago. I don't have a handover from the desk officer 5 years ago. So this thing prompted me to look at that. That type of exploration, partnering with a large language model, it is tough to say, at the end of a year or two of that, like, oh, we had better policy outcomes. It's a complicated thing to measure perfectly.
So, Garrett, I have the dream of, AI agent as consular officers, which we might not be ready for at the moment. We've talked about modeling our, adversaries or partners at the negotiating table. What other sort of things are you particularly excited about being potentially unlocked in the coming years?
Totally. And things are moving so fast right now that it's almost hard to sort of like evaluate what's going to be a year or two away. I think I'm excited about even just unlocking some of the work that we're doing right now, unlocking sort of access to large language models, generative AI. As I talked about, the department's currency, the widgets are words and analysis. These models are built to take an enormous corpus of data and to analyze it and to provide insights and to help people write better, do better analysis. You know, there was an analysis done, I think, by an academic institution where they took thousands of cables that had been declassified. So our cable system's declassified every 25 years. And they went back and they turned that into sort of like a knowledge graph, a database structure. And they started running analysis on things like, could you have predicted this global event based on the cable traffic? Was that even possible? I was also been saying recently, we have kind of a monopoly on this what we call kind of the diplomatic knowledge graph, right? It is this huge set of data that is constantly growing from our reporting systems overseas. And it allows us to have information that other sources don't have. Blending that with open source, with news, which is also where a lot of our information comes from, but evaluated and put into sort of refined text. Blending that and then allowing our diplomats and our civil servants to do just quicker analysis, summarize all this, tell me the 10 things that are important, give me some scenarios that we haven't thought about, or tell me what the scenarios are that we've evaluated for a crisis in this country. Now tell me the ones that we haven't thought about. These types of interactions just expedite knowledge work. They just allow people to be faster and be more creative. And I think we have the opportunity in the next year or two to start to test some of those things. There's no magic button. This is not going to happen overnight. What I'm talking about is like really hard work. It is IT work. It's policy work. It's safety and security. And we have to take all those things into account. We have to comply with the executive order and all of in my office, we have the responsible AI officer, the REO, who's a senior data scientist, a government employee, who is helping us think about how we evaluate the risk of these things. But then you know, we are lucky that we have a deputy secretary and the secretary who have both said, we need to try new things. We're open to testing things, to failing. Like, we have to be willing to fail and build something and say, this is a totally not helpful large language model or analysis. Okay, that's great. Let's improve it. You know, we need 2 weeks. We'll come back with another product. That's not culturally in our DNA, to be honest. It is a hard thing to say, we're going to try something. It's going to be bad. You're going to have to just accept that it's not going to be good in the first iteration. We'll come back, we'll try again, and then that's how we improve. It's much more common to say, we worked on this project for a year. Here's the release. This is the software. Now you got it. It's done. We try to be the opposite. Put software in front of people as quickly as possible. Test something. Let them say, I hate this, but I do like this. And then just iterate and deploy new things for our customers.
Garrett, thank you so much for being a part of China Talk.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Jordan.
我们所以才争执不断，无法估算，让我除了愤怒，怎么思考都是模糊的，一点波动就知道又要冲突了。任凭电视开着，没有人在看，继续化为讯号声响回荡，在试着预示才来采取代之狡辩，困着走不出来，却说这是狡辩。羡慕嫉妒，我们哪有那么好命？那些纠结都是缠绕蛇的暴力，这些小事，小的像是白噪，甚至跟我无关，不用假装哀悼，虽然可以忽略，却又被他缠绕。Yeah. 是催眠还是干扰？